Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday. Mondays are the day when you and I get to meet another man who's walking his path and he has agreed to share with us his story. Today's guest is no different. I am really pleased and excited to introduce to you author Lee Chavis. Lee Chavis has written several books for children. The most recent one is 100 Roses, which is written for children and young readers to acknowledge the dignity and the historically painful reality of incidents faced by African American women. Lee Chavis, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Now, Lee, I want to get started with learning more about you and who you were as a little one. So tell us about where you were born and your early experiences.
Okay. Well, I was born in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And as a young man, and you don't remember so much, I look at my young son now, he's seven, and I think back to myself and how little you really remember. And so it's a little, you know, it's like a small gift of, you know, when I observe him, how much he, you know, pleasure I get out of it, but how little he may remember of these days. But growing up, I from what I remember, I was an inquisitive kid. You know, you're just full of hope, full of aspirations, and you're just looking up all the time, trying to just go forward. That's what I remember about growing up, and I grew up in the days when we really just started having for school busing, and so there was a racial climate around, but. You know, as a child, you don't get it. You don't understand all that stuff when you're really small. You just, you know, like any other child of any race, you're just a child looking to the future and having as much fun as you can have. And, you know, you're just full of hope.
You know, there are so many children, sadly, who don't have even that fleeting experience, awareness, memory. So the fact that that is the memory that comes to you, even though it may feel like a small memory, is actually such a gift. And it is such a gift that your son walks in those same footsteps, feeling a sense of hope and positivity about the future. Too many of our children don't have that.
Right. And that is sad. So I never thought of it that way, that I had that memory, and I have to give thanks to my parents. So I never even thought of it that, you know, that was the impression that that question that you posed to me. I never really put it in that type of perspective. But yeah, it's and that's what you want, because that's what we're all humans at the end of the day, and you know, we want to enjoy our life experience.
So now you get to call your parents and say thank you.
Well, they're past, so, but I will say it in my prayers, that's for sure.
You can still connect. Tell us about your parents. What were they like, and what were their dreams for you as a little one?
You know, I think for my parents, my mother was from the Midwest and my father was from the South, and I think they were caught in a situation where, you know, that a lot of our people in the African American community are now finding themselves in a massive struggle just to survive. And I think my parents, you know, were just, if my memory of it is that they were in a pretty much a meat grinder trying to make it happen for the family. And I'm not sure if I know what they had in plan for me, except for back in those days, it was just to get you through, you know, high school for the most part, you know, make sure you're not in trouble, you don't get in any trouble. I don't recall any specific goals. I think we were, you know, pretty an average family that was, you know, kind of struggling and you know, really just hoping for the best without a specific game plan.
But, you know, even that, though, is a gift, because there really are families in which they see the children as sort of a mini version of them and will let the child know early on of what their expectations are for that child's future. So, again, it sounds like what you experienced was the freedom of your future being whatever your future was going to be, and infused in it, it sounds like a sense of camaraderie, family, and hope. I mean, that just is such an extraordinary gift.
Sure. I definitely know that it was full of love, and I knew that they were doing their absolute best to make sure I had every advantage that was available to them. And that was comforting. And especially just having two parents. I mean, you see the statistics today with the African-American child in a one-parent household. So I always look back and you know, you hear that the African-American father, you know, he gets tagged so much of, you know, in this irresponsible type of image. But you know, I give credit to my father. He was always there. I could always touch him. I could always, you know, hug him and talk to him. So that in itself, and mothers are always just rock solid. So for the most part, they're there through thick and thin. So it really gives me, that gave me it's a comfort that now I understand. But back then, you know, you take it for what it is. You take it for granted. You don't think about it. But yes, that of having both of my parents there all the time, you know, it's such a security emotionally.
Well, absolutely. And you begin to learn very early on important things about how to connect to people outside of yourself and how to love and how to care about others in addition to yourself. So it sounds like, I mean, there may not have been the financial resources that your family would have hoped for, but it certainly sounds like there was a tremendous richness in the home of your early experiences. Tell us about school. What are your memories about grade school, junior high?
Right. I remember that, you know, before school busing, you know, you were in a neighborhood school, and I just have all pleasant memories. And then I remember being we were part of the school busing, and I always remember being in an advanced class, just a few African-American students, and I remember just being harassed by the, you know, the white students, you know, calling you out of your name and, you know, just harassing you, chasing you, things like that. That always stuck with me, and it stuck with me so much that I remember requesting to be taken out of the advanced class so I could be with more of my friends in the lower class. And that's a hurtful experience, memory for me, because you never know how far you could reach if you just have the benefit to go through the system, you know, without being messed with. So that's a memory that I do have from when we started to, and that's nationwide, though. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't just, you know, particular to me, but, you know, I think that was the nation trying to, you know, get on the right track. But those are some of the side effects to that situation.
When you made the request to be removed from the class you were in, was that honored?
Yes.
And how did your parents feel about that?
I don't remember having a consultation with them. You know, I think it was at that point I was in junior high, and I don't remember it being a formal situation where the parents came in and spoke to, you know, the counselors or anything like that. you know, I think we were making, the nation was making its way as far as this integration thing, you know, trying to get, you know, neighborhoods mixed up so that we could have a better learning experience. So, yes, I think it was just something that I wanted to do, and it was honored. You know, I don't think it was a really hard, difficult process at the time.
That's interesting. We've been talking about your growing up years. Any siblings in the house with you and your mom and dad?
Yes, I have an older sister and a younger brother.
And tell us a little bit about them. How was the relationship with them?
Well, my sister is 5 years older than me. And then my brother is, my parents had him much later. So you have a situation where with my sister, we're kind of in a different bracket in life.
Sure.
You know, when I'm 10, she's a teenager. So we're doing different things. One thing I remember, though, she was more of a second mother, where she's always looking out for me, taking care of me. I give her credit for being one of my earliest sources of learning. You know, it was fun for her to play school with me and help me learn. And I give her just as much credit as teachers, because, you know, teachers have a whole class they have to pay attention to. So I'm getting one-on-one, you know, sessions with my sister. So that was a great situation. And then with my brother, as I said, we're so far apart in age. It you know, it's a situation where I'm more just looking out for his best interest, but it's, you know, the distance and age, you know, you're not running around playing ball together, that type of thing.
Understood. When you were in junior high and high school, did you have a sense of what you wanted to do with your life?
Not really specific. I would say that I knew that education was your way to advance. That much was clear. So I would, you know, try to do my best in school. I don't remember it being drilled into me. I just, you know, knew that in order to raise out of circumstances, education would be vital. And so I always paid attention to making sure, you know, I could read and write and know my math and take the classes, the next level classes, the geometries and the, you know, algebra 2, trigs, that type of stuff. I wanted to make sure I positioned myself educationally, because I just knew that was the way that you would go to the next level.
So it really sounds like even as a youngster, now I understand that teenagers don't particularly see themselves as youngsters. I know they're all 40, but for you, it sounds like there was a very mature looking at what life ahead of you could look like and what you could do to impact upon that life ahead of you.
I think so. I think I always was able to aspire for higher in a sense. I wanted to make sure I did my part to, you know, raise in my life's level. And I think that's important for anyone, is to realize where you are. Most of us want to go to a next level, a higher level. And so I think I was always in tune to, you know, I'm looking at, you know, that higher stage and how can I get there? And so, yes, I believe I was always just intuitively in tune to, you know, I need to go higher and how can I do that?
And your friends at the time, were they kind of walking the same path that you were putting forward for yourself?
I think, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, you have, and so then you have to, you know, pick and choose, you know, how much you do with anyone. I mean, you have good friends who are, and some people are not capable of going higher. I don't want to say not capable, but it just depends on, you know, each person's goals. So I had good friends who were, you know, they were all about having fun and enjoying the moment. And then I had other friends who were very studious. So it was just a mixed bag.
Do you remember the kinds of things you would do for fun?
Well, back in those days, it was great. I mean, you could roam around anywhere. You can get your dirt bike and, you know, you can just ride, you know, 2-3 neighborhoods over, no problems. You don't have to worry about being killed, being kidnapped, Amber Alerts, that type of thing didn't exist back then. It was a really great time to grow up. I mean, you know, disputes were just settled with fist fights. And everyone went home, they dusted themselves off, and, you know, the next day was the next day. So I have fond memories of growing up during those times when, you know, the world was a kinder, gentler place.
Did you have any particular special person in your life that you were dating or interested in dating?
Not really. I wasn't fixated on the dating scene growing up as much as I was fixated on elevating myself to the next level. I mean, of course, you have a crush here and there.
Sure.
And but nothing that distracted me from getting myself in position to go to a higher level.
Do you have a recollection of the kinds of things that worried you or that you were afraid of? Or was that even part of your experience in those?
I think I didn't have many worries until, I would say, when the crack cocaine epidemic swept through a lot of the urban areas, the black communities. Then it became a legitimate scare of death, because you had a lot of people just completely out of control, out of their minds. There was gun violence and that you've never seen before. So I think that was the first time I started to realize that I was in tune with an actual fear of, you know, my mortality, and that was when that epidemic came through our communities.
And how long did you live in the Washington, D.C. area?
Oh, I grew up there in all the way through my early 20s.
Okay, and so then there was junior high, there was high school memories. Anything in particular that stands out for you?
High school memories, for me, it was just, you know, you're having fun and you're going to school, this type of thing. But I think I just always had a sense of the future, of where I wanted to be in the future. So I think the overriding emotion for me was always making sure that I was trying to position myself to go higher. I mean, I know that's a recurring theme, but, you know, as we have this conversation, I now see that has been what my life has been about. It's been trying to not stay in one level until you get to a level that you want to be at. You know, some people may be at a level that they're happy with, but for me, it was always about I've always, and even now to this day, I'm aspiring to do more or do the most I can do with my life.
You know, again, what strikes me is that the ability to think in those ways, which sounds like was instilled, not necessarily the ability, but the sense that you could think in those ways, was gifted to you early on and perhaps even throughout your life. The self-awareness and perhaps the belief in yourself and in your own potential that becomes the foundation, the healthy foundation that even allows you to think about aspiring to more, to different, to broader, to wider. So many people don't have that. sadly, don't have that experience in their lives. And it seems like it was so much a part of the fabric of your life. It really does sound, at the risk of repeating myself, like an extraordinary springboard that allowed you to do all the things that you're doing today.
And I think that that's why I found this great passion of writing children's books now, because that's exactly what I'm trying to relay to the young African American children, that to instill that hope in that ability to know that you have power to control some of your destiny. And I think that's I don't specifically know where mine came from. I'm sure my parents had a lot to do with it, and different people you meet, but I don't remember that exact moment, and it's not clear to me when it was instilled. But yes, that's what I do with my work now, is that goal. That is my goal, is to have our children understand that, you can be in any type of situation, but you have to take some responsibility to dream bigger and to try harder and push yourself with whatever deck of cards your hand of cards you're dealt. You have to at least have the belief that you can go higher. And that's kind of the goal of my books.
Lee, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to backtrack just a little bit to your beginning awareness of your own interest and skills with writing. So, folks, we are talking with Lee Chavis, who is a African-American writer. We will return in just a moment. Author, African-American author of several children's books, I'd like to understand when you first became aware that writing was a passion of yours.
It happened when my son was born, maybe when he became 2-3 years old. My wife, she was out buying books, and she, we wanted to make sure we had books for him to start learning how to read. And I just instinctively started, looking for African-American images in the books. And so that kind of steers you towards historical books. And so we would buy the books, rent the books from the library. And I started to see a theme that, the storyline was kind of the same. We learn about Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson. And so it dawned on me that I wanted my son to see more of our story, and I couldn't find it. And so I said, this is not good for me. And I started writing books. And then I recognized that I liked putting the books together. I liked designing the pictures. I liked just wording what I wanted to be conveyed. And that's how it went. And so now I really found my life's passion. And so it's a beautiful thing.
So it sounds like you were living a life that did not necessarily include writing in the same way before the birth of your son. Is that a fair statement?
Sure, yeah. Most people do things that have no connection to their their passions. You know, you have to earn a living. You know, we're in a meat grinder for the most part where, you know, every week you're just trying to pay your bills and have enough left over to, you know, go to the movies and eat some dinner or take a trip. So I, you know, and you get into that rut. No matter how, you know, much money you're making, you end up taking on more bills, and so you got to fund that lifestyle. And that's how it goes. You know, 1 year turns into 5 years, which turns into 10 years, which turns into 20 years. And so my son shook me out of it just because I knew there was some information I knew he needed to know to become a proud and positive African-American person. We have so much potential that we're not displaying to the world, and we need to do better.
So tell us a little bit about your life before writing. What kind of work were you doing? What were your days like?
Well, I still do. I own a business that does nursing staffing. So that's really my my work. This is this writing is a new it's really a new situation that I just found out that I love to do it. And so I make it happen in my off time, which is extremely difficult. But it is true that when you find your passion, you will make it happen. And so before that, it was just working and living. You know, you work, you live, you know, you enjoy your off time. But the days go by. And then, as I said, years go by.
When you talk about the fact that you own your own company now, and it provides, is it a nursing home or does it provide in-home nursing care or both?
Yes, in-home nursing care.
Okay. So that sounds pretty stressful.
Sure.
On a regular basis. I mean, owning your own business is got its own ball of stress attached to it. But then with the populations that you're working with, it sounds like with the many kind of people that you're working with, it can be back-to-back stress. How do you manage the stress, the everyday stress, of being a business owner working in a human services field?
You just do it. We will all bring our own stress no matter what we do. I can't say my level of stress is any more than the guy who's working on the road crew on the highway in the hot sun, earning, you know, minimum wage. It's a different type of stress. So you just have to manage it and make it work for you. You have to pay your bills. So you do what you do to, you know, I think that's the overriding factor for most of us. We don't have that freedom to pick and choose sometimes of, you know, and then once you get into your groove of your career, it's not like you can just up and, you know, change your situation once you have your home and your, you know, your other responsibilities. So for me, it's, you know, that's why they build health clubs and all these different things. You know, you try to go to these things and de-stress, you know. So I think that's, it is what it is. I don't like to be a person who complains about things. I always am a person who thinks about a solution. You know, if there's a problem, I think you have to think about, okay, well, how can I, you know, affect this problem? How can I, you know, ease this problem?
And of course, the beginning of that is an awareness that there actually is a problem. And again, what I'm hearing consistently throughout our conversation is a belief that you can look at the problem, turn it around, and come up with a solution that makes sense. So again, there's just so much of, it sounds like, your early experiences that have been interwoven throughout your life, even as we speak today, particularly in the area of trusting yourself, respecting yourself, believing that you can make a difference. And with that assumption, you go ahead and make that difference.
It's true. And I, you know, when you're doing things and you're operating your life, you know, I don't ever think of it in those terms. It's just who I am. And I just wanted to, in my book series, that's, and that's how it goes, I guess, because that's kind of the goals that I'm attempting to help younger people to, because I think a lot of this starts early. I think a lot of this develops, you know, before the age of 10, where you really have to believe that you can, you know, do things and have a good self-image and a positive feeling about yourself. And so I guess it happened for me, you know, and now that's what I attempt to do. So I really don't have any, I don't have any specific memories of how it all came about, but, you know, I thank God it did. And I think we can, you know, we as adults in our community can affect more children if we all make that personal decision to help a child out of their family specifically. Because it's easy to, you know, you're going to look out for your family. But I think we could, you know, do wonders in our community if we all just decided to, you know, adopt a child or some concept that affects a child. You don't necessarily have to be a big brother or anything like that, but do something that will affect the younger people. Because here's the thing, the kids are, you know, they're 8 years old, 10 years, they're going to be major contributors to our society, you know, and 10 years goes by pretty fast. It's fast, a lot faster than you think. And so that 8-year-old today will be voting, will be, you know, starting to affect change and become leaders. So what we do for them now is critical.
So it really kind of sounds like one of your mottos is each one teaches one.
Yes, and that's the name of my company when I, my book series and the publishing company I created. It is EOTO Books. Each one teach one, because I think it's a old, long-standing statement, but you know, I think we've trailed off on applying it. And I think we have, you know, we have proven that we're extraordinary people from, you know, how we've risen in our history. But we have to now, you know, apply that that motto to go out and do something that affects another person. And so my theory is the children are just a ripe breeding ground for, they're open for things. They're just open. It's one thing that, you know, you get a person coming out of prison and you want to help them get on their feet, but there's so much to overcome. But it's another thing to get a child who the whole world is in front of them, and they're wide open for ideas and suggestions. And if we take some time and try to fertilize them, I think we can create amazing stories.
Well, speaking of amazing stories, you've just released something entitled 100 Roses. Tell us a little bit about 100 Roses.
100 Roses, I was writing books, and somewhere, you know, I really do believe in that, storyline that writers just get an inspiration. So I'm, you know, writing my books and from different experiences, then all of a sudden I'm thinking about the African American woman and how lately it just seems like her image is just being trashed and thrashed to oblivion. I mean, it's such a negative image that we see in TV and media in general. And so, you know, that was where the inspiration came. It's like, look, you know, I know better. You know, I know my mom, I know my aunts, I know great, positive, loving African-American women. And, you know, what is this I'm looking at on TV? And so I said, I'm going to write a book for specifically for young African-American girls and boys, but I want them to know, you know, look, we've done, you know, our black women have been just stalwarts in this history in America. They've been just amazing. So the spirit came in that sense, and then it just blew like the wind. I mean, you know, I didn't have really a game plan on how I was going to write it. It's just, you know, you're writing and then you get another inspiration. And it took me 4 years to write it, but at the same time, because you have to research it, and then I work. So it's not like I'm a full-time writer where I can just sit down and write, you know, 8-10 hours a day. I had to get up 3 a.m. Every now and then, a lot of times. And you know, you have, when you write when you work, you write when you can. And so it took a while, but towards the end there, I was just so motivated because I realized I had such a beautiful piece of work that is so inspirational. And it's, and so when I finished it, it was just one of the greatest feelings I ever had.
Can you give us like a little teaser about perhaps one of the stories within 100 Roses?
Well, what I did is I kind of canvassed through our history of all the amazing African-American women, and I just wanted to give like a little insight into their lives. You know, there's this popular song nowadays that's I guess that came about after these police shootings of the young black men, and the song is Say His Name. I don't know if you know that song. It's like a hip-hop song, but I think Black Lives Matter uses it, but it's an interesting piece of music. So my book is sort of like that. I want the kids to say their names, know who they are. A lot of times we just don't know our history.
It's true.
You know, it's not that we don't want to learn it. We're not exposed to it. As I said, when I started writing, it was more of, you're learning the same people over and over. And it's like, look, we know Rosa Parks about 50 different ways, you know, so let's use some energy for some other people. And the book, my book, that's kind of where it's at. It's like, say their name, okay? Once my son say, you know, he surprises me every now and then, you know, because before it was finished, I hadn't shown him the book, so I guess he would sneak and look at it. And so he came to me one day, and he's 7, and he's telling me about Marva Collins. And I'm like, okay, great. And that's what we want. We want our children to know these people existed, and to know that we have a blueprint for overcoming hard times. I mean, we're not just trying to figure this out right now. We've been doing this for 300, 400 years. And we have got to get these kids to understand, you know, what type of people we come from.
You know, I'm just imagining what it was like for you when your son came to you to talk to you about one of the heroines in your book. What did that feel like for you?
Well, it's just a validation of, you know, my new transition in life, that that it works, that, you know, a child can read. You know, it helps them with reading, number one, and it gives them something positive. And so when he came to me, it was just a validation. I was just like, yep, that's what I'm doing this for, is so they know these people, they know they existed. So now they know that, you know, I can do something myself. And I, you know, I do a lot of things with my son to empower him in general, but there's nothing like having a book in front of you to read at your leisure. Children like to read, and you give them a book, and they, you know, my son has books, and, you know, he's all, you know, when they get bored, I mean, he can't play the Wii, but so much. So you got to sit down every now and then, quiet time, and they'll go grab a book, and, you know, picture books are great because the pictures catch them, and then you put a story in there. And so they're reading and they're learning. and they're being empowered.
Lee Chavis, author of many children's books, the most recent is the release of 100 Roses. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about just the process of writing for you. Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back. Suggest that once upon a time in a land far away, the thought of picking up a book actually meant you picked up a real live book. In today's world, it could mean you're picking up your phone. It could mean you're listening to something in your car. Talk to us about your sense of where the world is going with respect to an appreciation for books and the ways in which books are made available to folks nowadays.
Yes, I think the thing about media, music, all this stuff, it's and that's why these people make so much money sometimes, because you know, it affects us emotionally, inspires us, all types of, we get so many benefits from these things, and books are definitely, they're here, they're not going anywhere. I mean, we're trying to electronic, digitize everything, but I think that with adults, that's a great thing, where, you know, I can have, you know, 10 books on my auto books file and listen in my car, this type of thing. But children, they're simple. You know, children like picture books. I mean, my son loves them, and children love them. They're learning how to read. So you can't give them but so much information because they're just learning how to read. But they love holding a book. It's like empowering for them. They're in control. You know, I'm reading with my kid. No, I turn back. You know, I'm on this page. You know, they're in control of this. You know, this is their little baby. And so I think books are just vital for the young kids. I think we definitely can. They're changing different ways to deliver books for the older people, and that's fine. You know, we definitely are evolving. But for the kids, you know, I think the e-books are here too. But there's nothing like giving a gift of a book to a child. I mean, it's probably the best book pound for pound. I mean, the best gift pound for pound you can do. You can give for a child.
That's an interesting perspective on the difference across the ages with books, and I think you're very right. I actually hadn't thought about that, but the little ones want to have something that they can physically hold in their hand and look at and really kind of connect to in a way that adults don't appear to have that same kind of need or focus. Maybe that's one of the not so great things about growing older. I'm not sure. You have formed your own company. More and more people are doing their own independent things just across many different fields. What's your sense of the future of self-publishing from your perspective?
Well, for me, it was just a matter of urgency. You know, I kind of put a few feelers out in the beginning, thinking I would go through traditional modes of becoming an author. And without any positive feedback, and I said, look, I'm, you know, I'm going to have to do this myself. And because I know what I want to say. And so I just learned along the way. And that's what we have to do more of. You have to just become proactive, because if I go through traditional channels, it may be, my kid could be 18 years old before he sees what I wanted him to learn.
It's true.
So I had to just go, you know, combat mode and just make it happen. And I didn't have any inclination I would ever become an author. And the point is, we can't let barriers stop us. You have to figure out whatever your message is, how you're going to do it. And so luckily, you know, I was fortunate enough to be financially stable where I could help myself make it happen. Because, you know, one of the major impediments for anyone is money. And so I had to make sacrifices, though. I had to, you know, not play the golf. And, you know, I had to save my money where I could, because it's not like you're going to create a picture book for free, or, you know, it's going to cost you something. And so that's a consideration. And but as with anything in life, anything that's of value requires a sacrifice. So I think with self-publishing, sometimes that may be the only way to get your message out there sooner than later.
Do you see that self-pub? I mean, it used to be thought of as the thing that you did because you couldn't get a real publisher to pay attention to you. Do you think that self-publishing in general has become more a part of the writing and more acceptable part of the writing and publishing landscape?
I don't know definitively, but I think it should. I think it should be. That's my own personal opinion, because there are a lot of brilliant people who just don't have a chance or just don't have the recognition, and they're out here. I mean, sometimes I'll travel to different countries, and I always think to myself, you know, you'll go to a third world country and you'll see these people struggling, and I think to myself, but there's probably a brilliant people in this populace.
Right.
They're very smart, and they just don't have opportunity. And so, you know, I think with in the writing, you have brilliant people. You know, have you ever been around a bunch of people in the old neighborhood, and there was always that person who was a great singer.
Right.
I mean, they could sing like crazy. Everybody knew it. And now, you know, 20 years later, they never did anything with that voice.
Yeah.
So I think the same thing with writing is, it's like people, we all have enormous potential, but a lot of sometimes it's about opportunity and the ability to make it happen. And so that's where the rubber hits the road? That old saying. I mean, that's what separates it, where, you know, can you make that potential into something, concrete?
Tell us about some of the other books that you've written. Have they all been children's books?
Yes, yes. Okay. That's my world. I mean, that's my joy. It's all about, for me, I think everyone needs to find a lane that they want to be in and try and, you know, throw themselves into it. So for me, it's just children's picture books, primarily African-American themes, because I just wanted kids to see more positive African-American images in media.
What has been some of the reactions that you've received from the material that you've written?
Oh, I've only received very positive reception. I mean, it's just hard to deny that we are underserving our history, the African-American history. Everyone knows it. It's like the worst-kept secret. And we just need to do more on our own. We can't wait for the school systems and whoever else we're waiting for to come in and, you know, just fix this problem. A lot of the fix is on us. You have to do what you can to expose your, my theme is to expose our kids to their history, because we are extraordinary. We were forced to be extraordinary. I'm not sure if we wanted to. We were forced to be extraordinary. We had to overcome some just absolute, you know, enormous situations to, you know, just to be normal, and then to, and now we've gone from being normal to, you know, rising to the top of industries. So it just says a lot about us, and I don't think we get it to the point where we understand that that's our fabric. That's who we are. We are just extraordinary people.
Can you tell us a little bit about Dreams of My Ancestors? What was that about?
That was, and that's a, my personal favorite, actually. As I think Roses is the most useful book for the broad general public. But Dreams of My Ancestors, I was thinking, wow, you know, we're called African Americans, but do we understand that African part? I mean, do you understand what that African part means? That those people were Africans who were from Africa. I mean, I don't know. We casually say it. And so I said, let me shed some light on who these people were. I mean, when they came here, they were African people, you know, didn't want to be in this situation. They were just brutally forced to do what they had to, you know, situation they were in. So I wanted to do a book for my son and for other children to understand who these people were, what their lives were like, that they were regular people like us who were living day to day, loving their families, eating foods, playing games, things that we do. I think the African-American history that we tend to focus on is the brutality of slavery. And so we tend to come away with a bad taste in our mouth that, you know, wow, we were slaves, we were picking cotton. You know, and that's kind of, you know, we don't get a little broader than that theme. And so we all carry that kind of slight of our history. And then we jump to civil rights. And so it's kind of a, you know, we leave out so much of our history. And I think there's so much to be told and so many nuances of our history. And this is just one. So Dreams of My Ancestors was one important piece that I wanted to bring out, is that those African people who came over here were just enjoying their lives like everybody else in the world, and then something crazily bad happened and changed the course of our history.
Do you find that in creating this material for children and sort of revisiting or visiting in a different way the truth of the African American history, does it ever anger you?
No, I don't deal with it in an angry sense. I feel like, look, America is what it is today. We played a vital part of it. Look, we're not slaves, and the you know, the white people who are living here now aren't slave owners. So everybody can chill out on the guilt. Let's just deal with the history. I mean, it is what it is. So I deal with it in a matter of fact way, that the facts are there. And truth be told, when the story is told, we come out to just be extraordinary people. I mean, it is what it is.
What are your hopes for your son?
Well, I look at it like this. I want him to be a happy, proud man first, and just enjoy this life experience. I mean, we get, you know, 70 years or whatever it is to breathe this fresh air, and it's a great, beautiful world out here. We've created a lot of nice, fun things that we can all do. So I just want him to enjoy it. That's the first thing. But then the second piece is to represent the African American culture and group in a positive way, in a responsible way, because part of the beauty of our world is that we're diverse. Everyone's culture has meaning and importance. And you know, we all like different cuisines and art and all types of things. And so ours is a piece of that. So my goal is to instill in him that enjoy your life and represent who you are and be proud of who you are as a man, and do what you can to also help our culture, because it's our culture, and it will live on. It's here. It's not, you know, it's a real thing that we all need to nurture.
For those listening who are perhaps inspired by your energy to pick up and do something that is a passion for you, what would you say to them, for those folks who are thinking, you know, maybe I have a story to tell, maybe there's some writing in my blood as well? What would you recommend as a first step?
Go to CVS, get yourself a pad, get yourself a pen, start writing. That's it. I know people, and people are inspired. I talk to friends, and you know, and great, everyone should write a book. I mean, what does it hurt? At least, you know, get it in a draft form. You have spare time. It's very therapeutic. So my suggestion is to get your pen and paper and start writing. It sounds so basic and easy, but it's true. Just start writing and go where your story takes you. And if it leads to more, then that's great. If it doesn't, then you'll decide if that's what you like to do.
I notice you say pen and pad. I didn't hear you say pick up your computer, your laptop, your. I didn't hear any of that. I just heard paper and pen.
Because that's the element. I mean, let's not create a barrier of I don't have a computer, or you know, whatever can come up. Get a pen and paper and start. Then you can transfer over to that word processor. But I think to keep it simple, get that pen and paper and go. Because I hear people saying I want to write, and I'm thinking, well, write, go, do it.
Okay.
Nothing stopping you but you.
Well, that's very true. Fair enough. Is there a website that folks can take a look at to learn more about what you're doing?
Sure. It's eotobooks.com.
Okay, that's...
And that's... right.
eotobooks.com.
Right. It's each one teach one, but it's just the letters, eotobooks.com.
Got it. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. It really has been a delight to speak with you.
Oh, sure. Anytime. Thank you for having me.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, the best way is by sending an email to Pamela, that's Pamela, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, that is exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.